And a week later, she announced that she would take up residence at Cabrini Green. I will keep that Cabrini Green apartment in the way that many suburbanites keep a downtown or in-town apartment, she said. I will consider it as a place to go on some nights and not on others. I will not give up the apartment so long as I am mayor. She picked as her new home what she'd heard was the most troubled of all the high-rises, the building where Larry Potts' killer lived, 1150 to 1160 North Sedgwick, The Rock. When the building's manager started showing apartments to Byrne's advance team, the first vacant unit he opened had a family living in it. He used his keys on a second officially empty apartment. Unofficial occupants lived there as well. By then, the overall population at Cabrini Green had fallen from a high of somewhere around 20,000 in the 1960s to 14,000. But the housing authority estimated that another 6,000 people likely stayed there who weren't on a lease. The head of the CHA guessed that 300,000 lived in the city's public housing, more than double the official count, and a tenth of Chicago's total population. A reporter who visited the high-rise before the arrival of the mayor's cleaning crew described the fresh urine pooled in one of the two elevators, the graffiti covering the walls, "Disciples kills all stones," and the fear he felt in the narrow corridors and stairwells. The toilets were out of order in the lobby. The screen door on the mayor's new fourth-floor apartment was punched in and lolling off its hinges. Second graders at Cabrini Green's Byrd Elementary, a school created to relieve overcrowding at Jenner, sent letters to Byrne urging her to stay away. "A lot of black people live here, and you are a white person. Roaches and rats might drive you crazy. You may be shot, stabbed, or assassinated." In 1978, Byrne had married Jay McMullen, a City Hall reporter with the tippling insouciance of an MC at a Dean Martin roast. When McMullen first visited The Rock, the elevator taking him up to his apartment broke down, stranding him and 11 others between floors. When freed, he walked the four flights, the light bulbs missing in the stairwells, trash piled up around the garbage chutes at each landing. "It ain't the Ritz," he told the reporters with him, but he wasn't too worried. "I've slept in some pretty unusual places in my life." The couple moved in on April 1st, 1981, arriving in a limousine and hurried inside by a security detail of 16. The apartment next to Byrne's was cleared so that two guards were stationed nearby at all times. Bulletproof glass panels were installed on her windows. President Reagan had been shot only 48 hours earlier in an attempted assassination. Byrne had received death threats as well. "While I was mostly philosophical about such threats," Byrne wrote in a diary of her stay that was published in the Sun-Times, "Jay was grimly humorous, stating, 'You'll be safer in Cabrini. The place has such a bad reputation, most assassins will be afraid to go there.'" She added, "And now it is our pleasure to take turns using a hand shower that our guards attach to the bathtub faucet. They don't live very fancy here at Cabrini." Byrne was engaged in a brazen political stunt, a ploy to jumpstart declining poll numbers midway through her first term. She'd won the black vote over Bolandic, but once in office, she'd reduced the number of African Americans in key civic positions. She'd installed a black interim police chief, but given the full-time job to Richard Brezek, a white veteran of the force. She removed two of the five African Americans on the 11-member school board, replacing them with whites who were openly opposed to desegregation through busing. Byrne had pivoted, hoping to shore up support among whites, but the backlash was fiercer than she expected. In Chicago's zero-sum racial politics, each of these moves was treated as a declaration of war. Relocating to one of the country's most infamous black ghettos would demonstrate that she cared about issues affecting the African-American community. As political theater, it was compelling stuff. Byrne was a small woman, heavily rouged, with a bleach blonde bob and a mouth that seemed perpetually pursed with nervousness. She was partial to mink coats, ruffles, and pastels. The local and national news ran with the story of this tough Irish woman living in the notorious housing project. She was like Kurt Russell's character in that year's Escape from New York, entering the ruins of the post-apocalyptic city, except she wore a purple suede jacket and a pink skirt. Mrs. Byrne is crossing the invisible but powerful line which has always separated the haves from the have-nots, wrote the Defender. It is a stunt whose redeeming political symbolism elevates it to the lofty heights of civic and moral responsibility. To her credit, Byrne understood the practical effect the media attention would have on Cabrini-Green. She occupied the seat of power, and she could bring that power with her to public housing. Wherever a mayor goes, there seemed to be city services galore, she said. Once there, she launched a sports initiative for the thousands of local youth, beginning construction on 3 new baseball diamonds and a football field on the site of the shuttered Cooley High School. 2 other parks received upgrades. Potholes were filled and cars towed. Workers from the city's streets and sanitation department swept gutters and picked up trash. Sod was planted, but it all died. Sewers were repaired. Plumbing and heating systems in the buildings received upgrades. Byrne created a new food cooperative at Cabrini. She sent staffers from human services into the high-rises to counsel truants, work with victims of crime, and help alleviate domestic conflict. 7 area liquor stores were closed, the city citing them for a range of electrical or structural violations, and hundreds of families were evicted, some for illegally housing parolees suspected of gang activity. Byrne opened a new misdemeanor court at a nearby police station to hear what was expected to be a torrent of new cases. A retired Army Major General, who'd commanded the Green Berets, was given the position of directing all security at Cabrini. A special task force of 50 federal agents from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was assigned to stop the trafficking of guns there. For the 150 Chicago cops who participated in a Sunday raid of the purportedly vacant apartments at Cabrini Green, she gave each of them white envelopes with $50 inside, money from her political fund, instructing them to treat their wives or girlfriends to a nice meal. Byrne also awarded $800 to 6 officers who solved a Cabrini murder. Police crowded the streets. Firemen and paramedics entered the towers without fear. More work went on at the housing project in 2 weeks than had occurred in the previous 2 years. Byrne's Cabrini sojourn led every TV newscast. Slightly different installments appeared in the morning and late edition newspapers. The Sun-Times ran daily opinion polls. Will Mayor Byrne's Cabrini-Green move make a difference? If you were Mayor Byrne, would you move into Cabrini-Green? The city council passed a resolution praising her decision to take an apartment there, and other city politicians announced their own intentions to stay in public housing. When New York City Mayor Ed Koch was asked if he, too, would consider a similar move, he said he'd grown up poor and had no desire to go back. Rumors, roaches, rats, and gangs are the curse of Cabrini, Byrne wrote in her Sun-Times diary. She mused on the subject of the cockroach, how she developed the reflex to sweep walls and let faucets run before using them, so much so that when she left town on business, spending a night at a luxury hotel in Manhattan, she found herself doing the cockroach check. "Did you remember to pack the raid, dear?" her husband asked drolly. She recounted going to bed to the CBS Evening News, just as she and Jay did most nights, though now they were in a Cabrini-Green bedroom and Walter Cronkite was talking about them. In one diary entry, Byrne described standing at her apartment window as white joggers waved and blew her kisses from Division Street. It was like seeing the first robin in the spring. We hope more will come by and not be afraid. A poll found that 60% of Chicagoans would vote for her if the election were held then, with 27% saying her Cabrini stay changed their vote. Two-thirds of those interviewed felt she was trying to solve problems at Cabrini Green, and nearly three-quarters thought the move sincere. In many struggling sections of Chicago that were not Cabrini Green, community leaders couldn't comprehend why the city was funneling its scant resources into a single 70-acre plot of land. There were dozens of other public housing developments in the city, and numerous neighborhoods in need of services and revitalization, most of them without the advantage of being a few blocks from the mayor's Gold Coast home. Many Cabrini Green residents also resented Byrne's presence. They accused her of creating a police state. Residents reported being stopped and frisked 5 times whenever they walked from a building to the corner grocery. Hundreds were arrested, almost all for misdemeanors, with just about every case eventually dismissed. Alex Taylor, who'd operated the 911 teen club in the basement of his high-rise for decades, received an eviction notice because his 17-year-old son was found with marijuana. Even Police Superintendent Brzezek admitted that his officers were treading a very, very fine line between maintaining order and becoming oppressive. The activist Marion Stamps was especially vocal in her criticisms of the mayor. Her community center, Tranquility Marksman, sat across Division Street from Byrne's new apartment, and she had a close relationship with the families in 1150 to 1160 North Sedgwick, the young men even bestowing on her the honorific Mama Stone for the support she'd given youngsters who later became Cobra Stones. Stamps was a short 35-year-old with a round, expressive face, often framed in oversized oblong glasses. But with her bullhorn voice and intensity, she gave the impression of someone of much larger stature. She was born in Jackson, Mississippi in 1945. And as a girl, she picketed the segregated public library that wouldn't lend her books. Medgar Evers lived close by, and the civil rights leader trained her as an organizer. When she was 17, she moved to Chicago, and in 1965, she landed an apartment in the 1230 North Burling building. Public housing, she said, was a godsend, a blessing, compared to the slum housing I was living in before. For me, the move to Cabrini Green represented something bigger and better. It was also a place, she would say, where social workers question your man and womanhood and think nothing of it. Politicians make promises of jobs and welfare checks for your votes, or no jobs and no welfare check if you don't vote the way the precinct captain has dictated. Then we have Chicago's finest, the police, who only serve and protect property and property rights. She blamed the street organizations as well. The misguided black folks among us who sell dope to our children, who intimidate and force our children into gangs. All of this compelled her into activism. At Cabrini, she raised 5 daughters and headed up the Chicago chapter of the Housing Tenants Organization. She ran a program for expectant mothers, since the infant mortality rates there were on par with those in the Third World. She pressed for a new school to be built in the community, one she helped get named for the slave-turned-abolitionist Sojourner Truth. And she despised the idea of Mayor Byrne as a white savior coming to Cabrini Green to rescue the poor black folk. With a flair for the incendiary, Stamps compared Byrne to the Ku Klux Klan, and told news outlets that life at Cabrini Green with the mayor there was like living in a concentration camp or a South African township under apartheid. When you are not free enough to speak up or go out of your house, you are already victim to a form of death, she said. The tensions came to a head at the mayor's spiritual Easter celebration, a day-long event held in the third week of Byrne's stay at Cabrini. A giant white cross was erected on Division Street, and the choir sang along with Byrne that God's got Cabrini Green in his hands. The event featured a Ferris wheel, men playing the bongos, free cotton candy, and circus rides. Reggie Theus of the Bulls, Chet Lemon and Minnie Minoso of the White Sox, and members of the Bears and the Chicago Hustle, the Women's Professional Basketball League franchise, all spoke from a stage about hope and revival. Byrne was introduced by one of her officials as the newest and one of the truest residents of Cabrini Green. In her memoir, Byrne said she responded to the event's low turnout by confronting the gangs directly, accusing them of scaring children away from the festivities. Division had become an actual dividing line between the Cobra Stones in the Reds on the south side of the street and the Disciples in the Whites on the north side. Even disciples from the Whites and the Reds saw each other as rivals. Pleading from the stage, Byrne implored children to go back to their high-rises to get their friends, since they'd surely hate to miss the free food and games. As the mayor sang an off-key Easter parade, protesters waved placards chanting, "We need jobs, not eggs." Byrne contended that the demonstrators were all gang plants, but they included a range of Cabrini Green tenants and other activists, among them Marion Stamps. Her organization counseled dozens of residents who were evicted when Byrne moved into Cabrini Green, and they managed to reverse almost every single case. Stamps stood alongside members of Slim Coleman's Heart of Uptown Coalition, a group that blamed the mayor's eviction policies for creating tensions between poor blacks and poor whites, many of whom were former Appalachian coal miners who'd moved to Chicago's north side in pursuit of a better life, free of black lung disease. Stamps said that the placing of the white cross in their black neighborhood felt like psychological warfare. She pointed out that Byrne managed to employ every convention of the white colonizer subduing a native population, appeasing them with religion, sports, petty entertainments, junk food, and trinkets. At some point, the police decided they'd heard enough. As officers cuffed and hauled the protesters away, a lawyer tried to intervene. "What is he being charged with?" he shouted. "Who's the arresting officer?" He was thrown into a paddy wagon as well. All the while, one Cabrini resident shrieked, "Assassins!" Byrne left on a California vacation the following week, deciding then to end her residency at Cabrini Green. In the 25 days that she lived in an apartment there, only one person had been shot. The crime wave had subsided. "We never will leave Cabrini, and neither should anybody else," Byrne wrote in her final diary entry. The mayor did return to Cabrini Green occasionally. She showed up later that year when two Cabrini teens opened the area's only newsstand. Over the summer, she led the ribbon cutting of a new athletic complex named for Severin and Rosado, the plaque stating, "This field is dedicated to all people who wish to live together in brotherly love." 100 dignitaries were in attendance, including family members of the slain officers. Byrne came out for a couple of baseball games, and her husband coached a team there for a few seasons. McMullen bought children mitts, and when the grass went weeks without a cutting, he called the park superintendent to get it done. But Byrne's bump in popularity from the Cabrini move was short-lived. Within a day of her leaving, news outlets were already going with the story of the housing development's intractable problems. Residents say services left with her. The 16-member security detail set up to guard the lobbies and monitor closed-circuit televisions were disbanded. The CHA said funding dried up. Byrne also undermined the goodwill she'd garnered with African Americans. For starters, she refused to get rid of Charles Swibel, who'd been abusing his position as head of the CHA since 1963. Swibel was one of Byrne's biggest fundraisers and closest advisors, and the two of them often rode together in her limo. From 1978 to 1982, 9 different reports by auditors and consultants found that the CHA was in shambles. The ninth of these reports was conducted by Oscar Newman, the author of Defensible Space. Yet Newman concluded that the problems in Chicago went way beyond bad architecture. In every area we examined, from finance to maintenance, from administration to outside contracting, from staffing to project management, from purchasing to accounting, the CHA was found to be operating in a state of profound confusion and disarray. No one seems to be minding the store. What's more, no one seems genuinely to care. By then, each housing development in Chicago had an average backlog of 1,000 unfilled repair requests. A survey of the 430 elevators across all CHA buildings revealed that 250 of them weren't operating. After a 9-month investigation, the FBI charged 6 CHA maintenance workers with pilfering millions of dollars worth of paint, floor tiles, and roofing materials. Byrne fired Zweibel only after HUD threatened to withhold federal funding to the city if she retained him. In his place, she installed her former campaign manager. At the same time, she also expanded the CHA's board from 5 to 7 members and appointed 3 white commissioners, changing the governing board from majority black to majority white. In 1983, after Byrne was voted out of office, her husband said he just so happened to bump into a pitcher from one of the Cabrini-Green Little League teams he coached. "Hey, Mr. J, are you going to be running the team?" the boy asked. "No, Lefty. We got beat, you know." Dolores Wilson. Like other tenants at Cabrini Green, Dolores Wilson watched warily as Byrne's time at 1150 to 1160 North Sedgwick came and went. Her sons were harassed as they walked to work and returned home. Her 2-door red Chevy, a gift from her son Michael, was towed and lost forever amid the mayor's wholesale cleanup. At work, her colleagues were so tuned in to Cabrini Green that they'd ask her about every violent event that had been reported in the news. "Oh, Dolores, are you okay? What was all that shooting about last night at Cabrini Green?" She hadn't heard any gunfire. If there was a shooting on Chicago Avenue, how could she hear it from her building a 1/2 mile north on Division Street? Now crimes committed anywhere on the near north side, 2 or 3 miles away, were being identified as occurring near Cabrini Green. "If you stub your toe at Cabrini Green, it was in the news," Dolores complained. Her youngest brother was so spooked that he refused to visit her. "Don't you read the papers, Dolores?" he beseeched her. "They're talking about how many people are getting killed at Cabrini Green." He worked at Mother's, a tavern with live music and a white clientele, a short walk due east of 1230 North Burling on Division and Dearborn Street. One night after his shift, Dolores' brother stepped out of the Gold Coast bar and 3 white guys jumped him, knocking out 2 of his teeth. It wasn't exactly funny to Dolores, but she definitely brought up the incident to her brother whenever she had the chance. "You said you're not going to visit me? I have my teeth. My family has their teeth. You're afraid to visit me because of what you read in the paper? Well, I'm not going to visit you from what I see happening to you." Hubert Wilson was promoted from assistant head janitor in their building to head janitor. He was now on call 24 hours a day, and they moved from the 14th floor to a unit on the 6th floor. In case of an emergency, he had to be closer to everything. Their monthly rent, 25% of their adjusted gross income, had been among the highest at Cabrini Green. Most residents paid well under $100. But the new position included the benefit of a rent-free apartment. Dolores said she felt like a billionaire. They could keep their whole paychecks. She bought herself an extra pair of shoes and spruced up their apartment. "I had all my interior decorating going," Dolores said. The kitchen was impeccable, with a shiny stainless steel microwave, a yellow tile backsplash, and a countertop lined with porcelain jars and decorative kettles. and they even had an extra room. Che Che, who worked for Otis Elevator and was married with a child, bought a house from one of his co-workers on the South Side. Michael got a job replacing furniture upholstery and moved with his wife into the Cabrini Row houses. Although Hubert now had a staff of guys under him, he refused to sit at a table with a pen. He liked physical work, and he still woke early to pull the garbage and run the compactors. The other janitors called him Old Man, even though he wasn't much older than many of them. One morning, 2 weeks after Burns' Easter festival, Hubert woke up with a bout of diarrhea. Dolores said she'd stay home to take care of him, but he shooed her off. He'd be fine. He didn't want to miss work. And since he was going to work, so should she. Then, like every day over the past 35 years, they kissed and traded I love yous. Early that afternoon, he phoned the water department to tell Dolores he felt ill again. He was going home. He'd eat some crackers and take a nap. When Dolores returned to their apartment that evening, she saw he was sleeping. Quietly, she warmed up leftovers so food would be ready for him when he awoke. Her daughter-in-law stopped by, and Dolores sent her to the bedroom to check on Hubert. She came running back into the kitchen.
"I think Daddy's dead," she cried.
When the paramedics arrived, they made everyone leave the bedroom. Dolores had put her fingers on the nerve in Hubert's neck. She thought she felt a pulse, but her own heart was pounding so hard it was difficult to tell. Hubert didn't look any different than he normally did as he slept. The paramedics finally came out of the bedroom, wheeling Hubert on a cart, a respirator in his mouth. Dolores stood to reach for his hand. Was he going to be all right? Could she ride with him in the ambulance? One of the paramedics pulled her aside.
"I have to tell you that your husband is dead," she said. "We had to bring him out that way so people wouldn't snatch at the body and scream. You know how people do."
Dolores took a short bereavement leave from work. When she returned to the water department, she told her co-workers that she didn't believe what the doctor said about diarrhea putting too much strain on Hubert's heart. She was pretty sure the paramedics had killed her husband. It was an accusation delivered, as was her way, as a mouth twisted aside, her voice remaining a trilling soprano. Her colleagues no doubt missed the simmering rage.
"Oh, Dolores," they assured her, "no doctor would ever lie to you."
But Dolores was, if anything, pragmatic. She didn't shut down because of a long list of perceived wrongs. She stayed busy at work and at home. She was a 52-year-old widow, and in 1981 she had been living at Cabrini Green almost half her life. She was soon offered the chance to leave Cabrini. Her grandmother, the one who moved around for much of her young life, had settled down in Englewood on Chicago's South Side. She'd bought a corner house with a coach house behind it where she let four men who'd been homeless live rent-free. When she passed away, the property went to Dolores' mother. And when she died, Dolores' brother was named the executor. But he already had a house of his own, and their sister Connie had become an evangelist and given up on worldly possessions, selling off her furniture and quitting her job at the post office. The family assumed Dolores would take it. This was her opportunity to get out of public housing once and for all. She could own a place of her own. But she wasn't interested. She felt settled at Cabrini Green. She told her brother, "I'm in the projects, but that's my home. I love my home, just like you love your home." The property went to her grandmother's church on the same street, and the church kicked out the squatters, demolished the two buildings, and turned it all into a parking lot.
Part 2. Cabrini Green, Harlem Watts Jackson. 6. Cabrini Green Rap. Annie Ricks. Annie Ricks was born on August 1, 1956, in Riverview, Alabama, the youngest of her mother's 10 children. They lived in a one-room cabin, and Annie and her siblings arranged their narrow beds like jigsaw pieces around a potbelly stove. They had an outhouse, a slop jar, a well from which the children towed water for cooking and cleaning. Her mother took care of a white minister's family, earning $2 a day, working 7 days a week. The Ricks children wore the hand-me-downs from the minister's flock. Riverview was a mill town on the banks of the Chattahoochee River, bordering Georgia. While Annie was growing up, there were separate schools for whites and blacks, separate parks, libraries, hospitals, and cemeteries. Annie would live in Chicago for almost 50 years and never once returned to Alabama, even after Riverview and three other mill towns were incorporated to form a new city and their names and segregated schools were no more. I told my own children they were blessed they didn't know about wells and snakes and the real prejudice Jim Crow law, Ricks would say. A constellation of freckles dotted the bridge of Annie's nose and reached her high cheekbones, which would sharpen to points each time she announced with a sly smile, "But I can't be mad." It was something she'd repeat her entire life, a calming mantra for whenever she felt adrift in the dark waters of a rage. She didn't know her father. He'd left when Annie was 6 months old. At bring your dad to school days, she just said he was dead, which to her he was. "You know you're stubborn," her teacher said. "Yes, ma'am." Her mother would tell her, "You're the strongest of my kids." When Annie was six, her uncle died, and the body was laid out in the front room of her aunt's house. Annie's sisters wept. One of them tore up her only pair of shoes on purpose to get out of going to the funeral. But Annie stared at her uncle without emotion until the casket was closed. She figured he had to be in a better place. Annie's oldest brother was the first to leave for Chicago. When he settled into a job, he sent for their mother. Annie, being the baby, made the journey next. It was 1967, and the cousin and her husband were back in Alabama visiting from Chicago. They let 10-year-old Annie ride with them on the return trip north. The cousin was also named Annie, and everyone in the family called her Little Annie, and Ricks by her middle name, Jeffrey. For the drive, Ricks put on her best dress and had her hair pressed. They rode through the night, reaching Chicago in an early morning downpour, stopping first at Little Annie's Southside apartment. To Ricks, it looked like her cousin had struck it rich. The tidy apartment had a shiny stove and wood cabinets and an indoor bathroom with a sink, a flush toilet, and a bathtub that included a curtain and a shower. "Jeffrey, you want to take a bath?" her cousin offered. "Yes, ma'am." Little Annie turned on the tap, and Ricks watched gape-mouthed as steaming water poured out. She luxuriated in the hot bath, soaking and submerging and twisting for a full hour. Then her cousin fixed her a breakfast of eggs, toast, grits, and rice, her first meal as a Chicagoan. After she ate, Ricks asked if it might be possible for her to take another bath. The second one lasted longer than the first. Within a year, the other Ricks children had followed Annie to Chicago. Their mother found a place for them in North Lawndale, a West Side neighborhood that had recently made the transition from a population of 100,000 whites to one of 100,000 blacks, a couple of generations' worth of shifting demographics time-lapsed into a few turns of the seasons. They lived on the top floor of a three-story walk-up in a three-bedroom apartment with a big kitchen, a living room, and a balcony. Ricks's mom would tell them, "Don't let the streetlights catch you." And Annie knew to be home each night before dark. But then she'd step onto the balcony and chat with friends whose parents were less confining in their rules. That's how Annie met Ernest Roger Bryant. His family lived in a similar walk-up, a couple of doors down. She'd whistle, and Ernest would appear at his window. They talked for hours. He was 2 years older, and they started going together when Annie was 12. He'd pluck at her globed afro, teasing that it wasn't her real hair. "You know what happens when you lie down?" her mother asked one day. Annie said she knew. But her mother meant it less as a question than as a warning. And when Annie was 15 and draping herself in her brother's oversized shirts, her mother knew what was up. Ricks gave birth to a boy, and they named him after Ernest. When she returned to 10th grade a couple of months later, Annie's mother watched the baby during the day. In her senior year, Annie became pregnant with her and Ernest's second child and left school for good. Leap ahead a few years, to the tail end of the 1980s, and Annie and Ernest haven't traveled far from the west side block where they met. They rented the second floor of a house just around the corner. Ricks was 33, and she and Ernest now had five boys. Ernest, Shannon, Cornelius, Kenton, and Erskine, named for Inspector Louis Erskine, a character from the TV show The FBI, and three girls. Kenosha, whose name came not from the neighboring Wisconsin town, but from the first initial of seven of Annie's closest friends, Latasha, and Ernestine. Rose, Deonta, Reggie, Raymond, and Raquan would come later. The neighborhood had undergone its own changes. International Harvester, Sunbeam, the giant Hawthorne plant of Western Electric, Zenith, the Sears headquarters, and many other manufacturers and retailers had shut their doors. Tens of thousands of jobs gone, with most of the smaller businesses making an exit as well. Just one supermarket and one bank remained. The neighborhood lost half its population, and it would have again in the coming decades. But Ricks had a job not too far away in a factory molding plaster figurines. She enjoyed the work. "I enjoy everything that I do," she liked to declare. Annie believed that if she followed the rules, if she kept up her part in whatever contract she signed, then she was entitled to all that was promised her. Their landlord lived on the first floor, and when the rent was due each month, she paid it. When something in their unit broke, the landlord fixed it. That was how the arrangement was supposed to work. So they all got along fine. One afternoon that fall, Ricks saw the landlord arguing with a man in front of the two flat. She didn't know what about, but she figured later that it was that man who torched their place. Annie's brother was staying with them, and that night, while they were asleep, he was the first to smell the smoke and yelled for everyone to wake up. They collected the children and scrambled onto the sidewalk, managing to grab a few framed pictures and toys on the way out. A half-asleep Latasha, hoping to curl up in bed, was on her way back through the front door when somebody saved her a second time that night. Then from the yard, they watched as their home and everything in it burned. They tried staying at a cousin's apartment, and then another cousin's place. Ricks bought groceries, took her younger relatives with them to a diner. But even family could do only so much. She came with a mob of kids, so many that they seemed to fill every space. When they spent the night, they covered the floor like a carpet. You couldn't put a foot down without stepping on one of them. Some nights, Ricks found herself herding her children along west side streets with no place to go. They walked a mile east to Cook County Hospital and huddled in the lobby. Other families were there too, and Ricks kept watch as her children slept. When Annie considered her predicament, the fact of it baffled her. She knew parents who were dope fiends and deadbeats, their children unkempt and uncared for. That wasn't her at all. She'd been providing since she was a teenager. Her children were well-fed and neatly dressed, their hair combed and cut and braided. She made sure they finished their homework and were on time for school. She volunteered.